Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
All right, welcome to Snacky Tunes. That was just Certain Creatures.
Juju.
No, that's XIUI, as I've been told. We have Oliver, aka Certain Creatures, in the house. He'll be playing later. He has one of the more exciting setups I have seen in a while. What is the name of the instrument that I'm looking at?
That's a modular synth.
Did you plug all these chords? I'll take a picture of it and put it online, but I mean, there's maybe two dozen chords.
Yeah, about that.
Man.
Yeah.
Awesome. Super excited to have you back.
Cool. Thanks, man.
It's always nice to have people back with different projects.
Good to be back. Yeah.
But first up, I'd like to introduce, I feel like I need like an 80s or 70s action event, like announcer voice to say your name. Bruce Cost.
Okay.
in the house of Bruce Cost Ginger Ale. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you, Darren.
Longtime lover of New York, came back. Now you got a giant factory that you're going to open where you're going to put, we're going to make all this ginger ale. But let's go back to the very, let's go back to the start. How did you get started in food? Was it a paternal thing, a maternal thing? Where did you fall in love with food and drink?
Actually, in New York City, it was Chinese food. I studied via Craig Claiborne with famous old Shanghainese lady named Virginia Lee, who had these great cooking classes in the 70s, actually.
My mother went to those.
She did.
She lived in New York. Her name is Gloria Bresnitz.
Uh-huh.
She learned how to make Chinese food at this woman's apartment.
No,
it
was on Mott Street.
Yeah, it was on Mott Street.
Yeah,
she made, and she like would make spare ribs and dumplings and things like that.
Yeah, good.
But yeah, so you took these classes and you fell in love. And
yeah, I lived in the city. It was a time when Chinese food was changing quite a bit. The first other cuisines were coming in, Sichuan, that type of thing. And then I moved to the country, to Rhinebeck, and taught Chinese cooking up there to Bard professors and
people
that lived in the river estates. And
what was that like? Paint me that scene. You teaching professors how to make Chinese food in the 70s.
It was a part-time job. I did it at night. I had an old country farmhouse, and I had put in restaurant equipment, a Garland stove, and I redid this whole place for cooking, and I had a garden, and so I started teaching up there. And then I ended up in San Francisco.
In the 70s?
1980.
I mean, they had their own food revolution going on.
They had their own food revolution. As a matter of fact, friends of mine had a movie theater in Rhinebeck.
Okay.
I saw a film. We used to invite film people to eat at my house.
Did you have
upstate films?
Did you have a name for the house?
Huh?
Was there a name for your house? Did you have a name for your house?
No.
Okay.
I mean, there were people named their houses that were on the.
Yeah.
There was a documentary filmmaker who came to eat named Les Blank, who died actually a few months ago. He had made Burden of Dreams. And he was at the Museum of Modern Art, and I cooked him a Chinese meal, and then I was in California, and he put together a group of people, Alice Waters, Ruth Reichel, Wayne Wong. At that time, they hadn't done anything. Wayne hadn't made a film.
Right.
Ruth was working for New West.
Could you feel, though, that something was happening?
Yeah, I mean, I saw Les brought a film called Garlic is as Good as 10 Mothers, you know, and Ruth Reichel had a bit part in that. Alice Waters, was doing her garlic festival. So when I said, I just want to cook out here and bring the lady who has that restaurant in Berkeley, and so he put together this great dinner of people, and they really hadn't blossomed yet. You know, we became friends. I still keep in touch with. So you could sense that.
You could sense like something was in the air.
Something was in the air, and they really helped me out. I wasn't in the restaurant business. They loved the food, so I worked at. You know, she brought me into Chez Panisse. We became really close friends with Ruth. We're still best friends to this day. And I started writing thanks to her. She's always been like a fairy godmother. So it was kind of a cool time. Now it's fun to be in touch with Wayne. He's making these cool films. And
do you still look at them and see them as, you know, the young dreamers that they were 30, 40 years ago? Or do you now see them as the big personalities that they are?
Well, when you know somebody for that long. I mean, you know them, you see them, and then, seeing Alice, I know she was involved in Roberta's a little bit, you know, and she's still has this part of these old dreams that she had.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where Ruth's kind of moved on and done a lot of stuff. She went to L.A. Times, New York Times, Gourmet and
Gilt City or Gilt Taste.
Yeah, Gilt.
Right? And, yeah. So you're out there, you're hanging out with these soon-to-be giant restaurant people. When did the restaurant bug bite you? When did you decide that you were going to throw your hat in the ring?
I was actually recruited by a Hong Kong group because I had a column in the Chronicle. I was writing about Asian food. I taught cooking classes, and I had the backing of kind of the food community out there. So I opened a restaurant called Monsoon.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't worked a day in a restaurant.
Where did you come in? At what level?
I was a partner and chef who created all the dishes.
Okay.
And then, the first 2 years of the James Beard Awards, I was nominated as Best Chef in California.
Wow.
And I wasn't a chef. I came to New York and sat there and lost to some other, you know, to the other chefs. But it was, that restaurant got a lot of publicity. It was a disaster financially. I mean, we just...
Where, was it food costs, or was it just the lack of knowledge, or...
I think it wasn't a good location because my partners had back in Opera Plaza. I think being Asian food and Chinese food, we had live seafood. We had, I had a lot of people come internationally. I was talking to Kavi the other night, you know, Lorenzo de' Medici.
Wow.
You know, all these people came to this restaurant. And then Alice would do dinners there, you know, but I think it was ahead of its time. I got criticized for selling Asian food at California and French prices, which was kind of a provincial... You know, I used the same purveyors, Monterey Fish.
Yeah,
I had.
Yeah.
So it was just... Everything was at Ersatz Mediterranean. You know, I mean, it was not a time for Asian food in the 80s. So we got tons of critical acclaim. We're in every publication. I mean, we had color pictures in the New York Times and stuff like that. So it's... and I didn't know what I was doing. You know, my staff ate better food than most, you know, they'd be eating.
Oh, yeah.
I just...
staff meal was fun.
Yeah. I mean, it was a lack of my own probably sense of... I did the best stuff I could, but it you know, it's just hugely expensive restaurant. So a guy named David Leibovitz was my pastry chef. I don't know.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
David has his famous blog now.
So. Yeah.
I mean, every dessert he made... We lost $2, you know. I mean, it was just...
But it was the best dessert you had.
It was a great dessert. He could just do what he wanted. So it was a... And, yeah, it was kind of a central place for...
You're like, we're having too much fun. Everything tastes too good. Something's going to drop.
Yeah, I mean, there were problems. Some problems with my partners, so forth.
And so you went on to open up... a few more restaurants in the area,
yes,
which is where this whole ginger ale thing started to sort of happen, right? You had Ginger Island in Berkeley, Ginger Club in Palo Alto. How did those restaurants start, and how did the whole... Why did ginger start becoming a big player? Did it pop up during your Chinese cooking, or where did it start?
Yeah, I'd written a book on ginger. Also, my first book was in the era. But we had done a Chinese medicinal dinner at Monsoon, and David... formulated this, and we put it was a medicinal medicinal book that these people came out with, and we put ginseng, astragalus, and herbs in the ginger ale, and then we kept on serving it, and then we had a doctor's convention book this medicinal dinner. I'd have to give talks. We had you know, soft shell turtles and all these different things, but then I went and open ginger. Actually, a local restaurateur has NoHo Star here, and he has the Temple Bar.
Yeah.
George Schwartz.
Yeah.
He had a disaster. He had bought the 4th Street Grill in Berkeley. That was, you know, one of the original, that Southwest cook, Mark Miller, had that. I don't know if you remember all that. But anyway, he was hemorrhaging money, so I took that over, and I was more disciplined and made a deal with him. So we had this ginger island. We introduced the ginger ale on the spot without the herbs, and people just started drinking it. So.
That's when you finally took the herbs out, when you had this first recipe, which is now the recipe used today.
Yeah.
Did you have that aha moment that you knew it would lead to this, you know, ginger ale empire? Or you're like, this is a pretty good drink. I think people are going to like it.
People did like it, and it wasn't that surprising because Ginger has kind of, this affinity for mankind, like coffee and tea, really.
Yeah.
It makes you feel good, and it's not just a flavor like strawberry or acai berries or whatever. It started selling, but I didn't think someday I'd be in Bushwick with a factory back in 18...
what was it, 90... When was it, 80, 90s? What year did it go on the menu?
It went about, 91 or 92.
92.
But then I decided, I'd done a lot of things in food that I would take a company public. I'd had restaurants, and so I went down to Silicon Valley and raised money to open a place called Ginger Club. I had the backing of some of the venture people on Sand Hill Road. It was another financial disaster. I was stuck in it. It wasn't bad enough to fail, but it wasn't good enough to get me out of this place. And then I was recruited by a guy in the Midwest, a famous restaurateur named Rich Melman.
From Let Us Entertain You, right?
Yeah, he started that. He's an interesting character. He came out there and he said, come with me. We got this little space and you don't have to stand here all day and manage the books and so forth. And so he had this little space. We started this Big Bowl, not a great name, but we had good food. It still does. We grew it and we sold it to Brinker International. So instead of being, a starving writer that was heavily in debt from, it changed my life a little bit.
I feel like when you're an artist as yourself, you go from, creative and debt and debt and debt, and then one day it's just sort of like, you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Like, maybe being the beauty and idealism of, being the starving artist is not as much fun as being able to take a taxi home.
I think you can do both.
Every once in a while.
Yeah. I mean, I was getting old. I told one of my a neighbor friend of mine, Maria Vella, her family had this Villa cheese out there. I eat with her all the time. I said, Maria, I have to start making some money. I had a contract for a book on the world's oldest collection of recipes with a scholar, and I hoped to finish it someday, but I just couldn't do it anymore. So when I had to move to Chicago and started this kind of chain of restaurants.
Well, let's take a musical break, and then I want to get into the growth of getting that ginger ale, because it's amazing to get a ginger ale out of a restaurant and just sort of everywhere. So here we go. We'll be right back. This is Seasons Waiting on You by Future Islands.
Thank you.
Oh man, that song is just, it's the it song right now. If you haven't seen them on Letterman, it's amazing. So we're here with Bruce Cost of Bruce Cost Ginger Ale. We are talking about, well, we've gone up to the, I would say, the mid-90s of your story. Mm-hmm. And so the ginger ale's at all your restaurants is getting more and more popular. And then tell me about the moment, or I guess the period of time, when you saw it as not just a drink on your menu, but as an actual product that you could bottle and sell.
When I left, I was leaving California to go to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Rich was going to be my partner. Mm-hmm. It's a big company, so I wanted him to not only do food for these restaurants we were going to create, but to bottle the ginger ale. And I'd put together a big distributor on the West Coast and people that could... consultants from, you know, go for it. He's a smart guy, so he said, I'm not in the beverage business.
Fair enough.
And then he's a good guy, so I was there several years. We created this chain of restaurants. We sold it to Brinker, and then I hated being with them. I was commuting to Dallas. I was a vice president. I had stock options, and it was, you know.
Very corporate.
I would just sit in meetings. You know, it was horrible to get up in the morning and fly from 6 o'clock to Chicago to make a 9 o'clock meeting in Dallas.
Oh.
And then it was just not for me. So we started a little chain called Wow Bao, which was these very good steam buns, Chinese buns. But I became frustrated after a while. We never did much with it. I mean, there are three or four that are very successful. We had people... that wanted to buy it, franchise it, and, you know, Rich wasn't that, you know, he likes big places, his
right.
son's got, so I said, I want to move back to New York, and I want to put this under my name. He knows I brought it into the, he's a good guy. Yeah, I said, okay, I mean, I still have an apartment out in Chicago, I was commuting back and forth, Chicago just, it was nice. I was downtown. It was a nice, clean city. It was so exciting. You know, you'd leave Chicago, come in here on a Friday night, be in the Lower East Side, get this burst of energy. And so, you know, I was thrilled to have an apartment in New York City.
New York is just, it's alive.
Yeah, it's flourishing now. I mean, I lived here in the 70s. I mean, it's just flourishing.
Yeah.
Actually, you sit there and you have an apartment in Manhattan, and it's hard to believe. So, my partner, who was making dumplings, has a Brooklyn factory in Williamsburg. He was making 200,000 Chinese dumplings to my specs every week. We were buying this
wow.
for these 11 restaurants. He's another good guy, and we became friends, and he said, let's jerry-rig part of this factory and make this ginger ale. he hadn't done it either. So we said, why don't we try to do it in 2 months, and then we'll take it to Hong Kong, the natural food show, and see how the Chinese guys like it.
So you're saying that you took, in 2 months, you went from, you took a dumpling factory, turns into a bottling factory.
Well, no, it's a big, I mean, it's 130,000
okay.
square feet.
Okay.
We
okay,
took
okay.
A little
area, okay.
A little tiny area, and we made this batch, and he just wanted to see, he's from Hong Kong, a smart guy, but he wanted to see how it would play in Hong Kong. And so he and his brother thought, to see if it had worldwide.
Yeah.
He said, well, we like it. Let's...
Let's do this.
Yeah, let's do this. He had never done anything like that.
That's another great thing about New Yorkers.
Yeah.
Who are just... They're just like, I love it. Let's try it.
Yeah.
Let's go for it. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, Richard would have... We'd have never created the labels. I mean, he's more of a micromanager type of thing.
It's a great design. Did he come up with the logo and label and everything?
No, I did. I mean, I did it, and then we tweaked it. Brooklyn graphics guy. So we just started producing it, and you know, lucky for us, it started selling word of mouth. You know, it spread around Brooklyn. We took it to a couple of neighborhood restaurants in the Lower East, you know, kind of cool young Anchoy. I have a friend from California, Barbudo, Jonathan Waxman.
Oh, yeah, of course.
He's an old... He was at Chapinese, you know.
Yeah.
And he did...
It's amazing how those relationships just continue through the years.
He's a smart guy. He went to Stanford. And then I went back to San Francisco and the slanted door and a lot of people, they just took it. You know,
so. What year is this?
We started in 2000... 3 years ago, 2010, actually.
Wow.
We actually went to a natural product show in Boston with the first batch we made that we had taken to Hong Kong. And Whole Foods in New York wanted this, but I didn't like the batch. I mean, I just didn't.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm not going to sell it. You know, I'll wait. I'll get back to you, you know, when I get a batch that I like, so...
You're probably the first distributor to turn down Whole Foods.
I think that's advantage to having done a lot of things.
No, of course. You know, I mean, like, that's the wisdom of being in business, of just knowing to...
Yeah, and it's something I don't ultimately have to do.
Right.
So we did... I worked on it 6 months, and then we went back, you know, to certain Dean & DeLuca, certain store, restaurants. David Chang picked it up right away. It's on the menu. I mean, some of these guys still remember, whatever, Bruce Cost, Unfiltered Ginger Ale. So a lot of the restaurants, and we went into Whole Foods, Dean & DeLuca. The Japanese saw it in Dean & DeLuca and started writing blogs about it. It's hard. I mean, we have a lot of good stories. It's brutally hard, you know, to get yourselves on
the shelf. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Shelf space is one of the most competitive spaces in any industry. Yeah. And to not only get in there, to stay on there.
Yeah.
Because you got to sell.
But we were lucky because everybody has sales forces, and we did spread organically. Like, fortunately, you know, I'm in a city where people will pass things around real fast if things could. And so that happened in New York, Washington, D.C., San Francisco we went into because I used to live there. So we were in Whole Foods out there right away. Google picked us up. Their staff voted on us. You know, they give out ginger ale. They give out snacks and beverages in these little micro kitchens, and they invite you, and you have to be voted on and all this kind of stuff. And
so tell me about this new factory that's happening right here in Bushwick.
My partner that had the noodle and dumpling factory sold it, the business, to a giant Korean. He'd done it for 25 years, food manufacturer, 130,000 square foot old brewery in East Williamsburg.
Wow.
You can imagine having a 130,000 square foot factory in East Williamsburg for 30 years that it's worth more now.
Just a little bit. just a little bit.
Back then you'd get funds for...
Just coming out there.
Yeah. Just coming out there. All coming.
Oh, you want to go out there? Here's some money. Thank you. Thank you.
I don't want to go out there. I'll go out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he sells it.
He sold it. Plus his business was thriving. So he... he's just been a great partner. So he said, you know, let's find a space. And I mean, you can't, I think somebody wrote, there was an article in the Post, you can't look for stuff in Bushwick and decide you're going to be here if you're opening a 20,000 square foot factory.
I mean, right.
We were lucky. I mean, we did find that space right away, but it's within walking distance of the others where we worked before.
Right.
And then FedEx, which is nearby, came and just took it away from us, you know, essentially outbid us. And then so we looked at 50 spaces in Brooklyn, and it was, prices go up by the week.
You know? Right.
It's horrendous.
I mean, yeah.
And my partner would have either bought a space, which ever was faster. So we weren't having any luck, and then this deal fell through with FedEx, and so we took the space. And we've just moved in. We've done production there. We have boxes around. But this space was fun because we could do it the way we wanted.
Yeah. Know,
make it a Brooklyn kind of office space. So we're just there 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Fresh. Paint drying.
Spring. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now you have a new flavor as well. I mean, you have the original flavor. And then
yeah, we had three flavors to begin with.
Three flavors.
Yeah.
We had back in the restaurant days?
Some of them were at the Chicago restaurants.
Okay.
So I took what sold, like a pomegranate, it sold there, and I... you have to do it a little bit differently. You
know,
we used to have a green tea brand, which was made with matcha, that bright
green. Oh, yeah.
And right before we sent off these fresh syrups to our bottler, we had mock bottled a couple of these things to see how they would sit for 2 or 3 weeks. And my partners were sitting around the table, and the matcha looked like pond scum.
You know,
so we said, we can't sell this, but we're ready to send it off. So he's the biggest dealer in bubble tea stuff in the United States. So I just looked around at what they had, and they had these cryovac packages of a real fine whole leaf jasmine tea.
Mm.
So while the syrup was warm, we quickly made it, infused it, and sent it off. And it tastes, you know, people liked it.
So yeah.
Pomegranate. Then we did a passion fruit. But we always use very good stuff. So I was buying this pomegranate extract concentrate from Napa Valley. And the first bottling was, it cost 27 cents a bottle just for the pomegranate.
Wow.
It's 99 cents to bottle this before you pay people.
Right.
My partner was, you know, what?
Yeah, he was like,
what are you going to have to...
What's that line on the P&L?
I said, oh, you know, we'll bring it down. So now we have a passion fruit with a pulp from Ecuador. We have a 66-calorie version with a monk fruit.
Right. Another old Asian ingredient.
And that's selling pretty well.
So do you still cook and tinker and make Chinese food and come up with?
I cook more now than I did ever. You know, we're near Essex Market. We're near Chinatown.
Yeah.
So probably every night we have the best food in New York. I mean, just.
So what's the future of Bruce Koss Ginger Ale? What's new flavors, bigger distribution? How many countries are you in right now?
Well, we're not thoroughly within the United States. I mean, we miss big pockets of the U.S.,
yeah.
But, you know, we're in the Bay Area. And
yeah.
Chipotle's new Shop House franchise picked us up and it supports us. And I mean, we're in Japan where they don't drink soda. We were just in Japan a couple of weeks ago. We're in the Tsukiji Fish Market. I mean, it's exciting.
Oh, yeah.
We're in some geisha houses. We can't go in. We're in Kyoto. We're in... cool coffee shops in Japan, but they don't like soda, you know, the gathered stuff. But this, with the namashoga, the fresh ginger is a different drink to them, so.
That's great. It doesn't taste like soda to me.
Right.
Like, it's got a great, like, mouthfeel. Like, it feels very rich, not very thin and sugary.
And very, yeah, and Canada, we have a good, you know, it's mostly distribution, who you make partnerships with. So we finally got a mega... DSD, one of these old line beverage distributors that has in the Boston area called Polar. They're from the 1800s, and they, you know, they have 10,000 accounts in Boston. But, you know, and I have a young saleswoman, I decided, you know, it's a male thing, this beverage distribution in supermarkets, and it's tough. And I had this great young woman who, like, was the best top salesman at this buy, which is a weird drink, and she just
owns it.
She owns it and can't understand why it's not on every shelf. I mean, so
that's what you want.
Yeah, and we picked up a young lady from a girl from Pepsi that texts us every day, that 25-year-old that was making a lot of money at Pepsi, but saw her future with this drink. So,
Oh, to be young. Well, Bruce, I can't thank you enough.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing the beverage as well. It's super delicious. What's all the... you're up on social media as well, right? Instagram, Twitter, things like that?
Yes.
What's what are the nuts and bolts? Where can they find you?
So we're at Bruce Cost Ginger Ale for Facebook. We're Bruce Cost Ginger Ale on Instagram. And on Twitter, we're at B Cost Ginger Ale.
That's just for... There's no other Bruce Cost Ginger Ale. That was just for a spacing thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Bruce Cost Ginger Ale, too. Well, Bruce, thank you so much. Good luck to you. Thank you for bringing you know, business like this to Bushwick.
It's
the
fun.
The government didn't pay this time around, did they?
No, it's fun. It's...
All right, well, we have a song coming up from one of the better bands that came out of South by this year, a Canadian band called Pup. This is Reservoir, and up next is Certain Creatures Live here on Snacky Tunes. Oh, man. Toronto punk. How old... I mean, I don't know. I imagine those kids are, like, 19. Maybe. maybe 20. That sounds like a band of a 20-year-olds, and I just go, no, jealousy. Man, shout out to Bruce. Stories.
Yeah.
Stories for days. I gotta go by the warehouse and I
want him to cook me some Chinese food.
Seriously. So Oliver, welcome back.
Thanks.
Second time.
Good to be back.
Good to be back. Coolest piece of musical equipment.
Tight.
Actually, Danielle also had this really cool square button thing that was all samples. It was like 64 different samples.
Wait, which thing was that?
I don't know. It was like this big, like, mm-hmm. Remember those old calculators? Or like it was that old multiplication table. It was like, you know, 8x8, you press into 64.
Oh, yeah.
He had
a
musical thing that looked like that.
Oh, yeah. Like an old school big one?
Yeah. But it was new school.
Yeah.
Oh. So you were here with another group before.
Yeah, I was here with Warm Ghost maybe 3 years ago, maybe.
And now you are back with Certain Creatures.
Yeah.
So what happened with Warm Ghost?
I'm
kidding. We never ask questions like that. No.
Wow. Going.
Yeah.
Right for it.
Yeah, that was not so much a softball, but a dodgeball.
Yeah.
So that ended. Now you're doing this.
Yeah, I'm doing this. Yeah, I kind of just, you know, decided that I just wanted to kind of find my own musical identity and kind of do it on my own, not have to worry about having bandmates. And
hey, man.
Yeah.
It's like being in four relationships at once.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So tell me how this came about. So, you know, you've obviously been doing music forever.
Yeah.
And you were down in Miami?
Well, yeah. I mean, I moved. I lived in Florida. I pretty much grew up in South Florida. Since I was, I moved there when I was 15. Kind of grew up in the, you know, kind of came out of like the punk hardcore scene in the early 90s. And then by like the late 90s, it was like heavy, like all that electronic music happening in Miami. Like really cool stuff that was happening. It was really more DIY and very, similar things happening with like, you know, the punk scene, you know, whereas, you know, playing in like warehouses and galleries and stuff, so it wasn't so much like the techno rave scene that I was like super involved with, but you know, more of like the IDM, more experimental side of things, you know.
And that, I mean, that was where I go, but that influenced you to do this.
Yeah, I mean, this project, I mean, it is electronic music, but I kind of feel like my range of influences is sort of like all over the place, and this sort of takes all of them and puts them in a blender a bit.
Do you edit yourself?
Yeah, I do. Everything.
Are you your harshest critic?
Yes. Yeah. It's sort of if I don't pump something out and record it and like that's it immediately, then I'll sit and work on one song for, you know, 5 months.
Do you ever beat yourself up and then go and be like, man, Oliver's a real dick today?
All the time.
Yeah. All right, well, let's hear a track and let's talk about... quick question. Miami, or Florida, do you actually have a place where you can get a good Cuban sandwich? Have never found one.
Oh, wow. There was, like, this one truck that was by this spot called Churchill's in Little Haiti. And it was amazing. I don't even know if it's still there. This was like, you know,
right.
2000. Maybe it was the last time I was there. Yeah.
All right, we'll check next time we're down there.
Cool.
What's the first track you're going to play?
Well, so all of the tracks I'm playing, kind of, they don't really have names. And none of it's recorded. They're just like kind of the portions of my live set, which is really just one giant piece of music with sections, basically.
Amazing.
So I'll just play like different sections from the live set.
Okay, so this is section. We'll call it section one.
So this is like a newer thing that I kind of just did today. So we'll see how this turns out.
Called Snacky Tune Live Exclusive. Certain Creatures. Here we go.
Thank you.
Man. I think I could listen to that all Sunday.
Yeah, I could have gotten into a deep wormhole and done that for about an hour.
Yeah. What's your sustenance when you're doing that stuff? Are you, what are you eating? What are you drinking? Like, what's your fuel?
A lot of pizza.
Yeah.
I actually cook a lot. So I, you know, try to cook a lot at home. A lot of pizza, a lot of Indian food. A lot of, I live right by, Union Pool, so I go to the taco truck there.
It's so good.
Fairly often, yeah.
I feel like it's under the radar. I mean, not,
yeah.
I mean, I think part of that's just because, like, it's in Union Pool.
Yeah.
But they make solid tacos.
They do, they do.
I've definitely looked at people's Instagram feeds and seen them posting those tacos and go, where did you get those? And
yeah.
It's like, oh, it's the El Diablo truck.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's great. I mean, it's kind of funny, like, walking into a bar just to get some tacos and leave.
It's not the only thing you can get at Union Pool.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I'm saying? Right. You know what I'm saying?
Just be careful where you sit.
True story. My girlfriend now, who I just moved in with,
yeah.
We had a joke about, like, going to Union Pool and picking up people and, like, how gross that was.
Yeah.
And then the night we went out dancing there is the first night we went home together.
Oh, wow.
So,
yeah.
I guess.
Look at that.
Look at that.
I one time, years and years ago, was sitting at a bar with my girlfriend at the time and was approached by another couple who wanted to take us both home.
Ooh.
And we were like, what?
And they're like, are there tacos involved?
Did you say Pastor Burrito?
So talk to me about this album. I mean, it's the new piece. I mean, it's epic, right?
Yeah.
It's, like, it's, we can use that word on this.
Yeah, epic has been used to describe it. Yeah, it's basically, I did this 12-inch for this Brooklyn label called Styles Upon Styles, and they have a 12-inch series called Bangers and Ash.
I like that.
Yeah, so the banger side is supposed to be, you know, meant for the dance floor, you know, your interpretation of a banger. And then the ash side is meant for, you know, music to smoke to, something a little bit more experimental or chill or whatever. So instead of, you know, doing something chill, I kind of did something a little bit, you know, it's a little dramatic and creepy and, you know, it's kind of like walking down a creepy street in New York City and, you know, in the 70s or 80s, you know.
I'm sure Bruce could have spoke to that.
Yeah, yeah. And I got this man, Stuart Argerbright, who has become a collaborator of mine. He was in this, or is in this band called Ike Yard, who had been around in the late 70s, early 80s, around the no wave scene in New York City. You know, their first band, first show was with Lydia Lunch and Suicide in like 1979 or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
So this guy's been around for a while. And I was a fan of their music and just randomly hit him up on Facebook. And he listened to this track that I had sent. I had sent him this track thinking his voice just needs to be on this. This yeah. is the only way the song's going to make any sense because it was weird.
Hey man, this is on you now.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Exactly. So then, yeah, he responded fairly quickly and he came over and just drop vocals on this, like, did three takes. He kind of, like, improvised it, more or less. You know, and it was, like, the song was a mess. It was just, like, me doing improvisations yeah. with my modular synth, and I kind of, like, strung a few of them together, and it was, like, this 13-minute song, or not song, really, even at that point, that really didn't make any sense at all. But once he had, you know, tracked the vocals for it, I was like, wait a second, this is kind of creepy, weird, you know, some weirdness happening here. So it took a few months for me to sort of wrap my head around what he had done yeah. and what I needed to do musically with it.
That's great, though.
Yeah, so it all kind of came into fruition.
It's nice when you, it's like, I sort of love that moment when it seems just all crazy and all over the place, and then you change a couple things and it all locks in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's beautiful.
Oh, it is. Because it's like being completely lost and then...
Be like, oh, shit. Yeah. There's that Cuban truck.
Right.
do you want to play another section for us?
Yeah, let me do that.
Cool. All right, here we go. Live on Snacky Tunes. Thank you. I feel like a time warp. Whew. So what's next? What are the plans?
Right now I'm co-producing a record for Black Rain, for this UK label Blackest Ever Black. Black Rain is a project of Stuart Argabright from Mike Yard, who I was mentioned earlier. So we're just wrapping that up, and that should be out on Blackest Ever Black in June or July, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm just, as soon as this is done, I'm working on my first full-length for Styles Upon Styles. And, I don't know, hopefully playing some shows around New York and hopefully outside of New York as well.
So when you go on the road, what's a live show going to look like?
The live show is pretty much this. I have this guy, Zoe, doing visuals for me.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it kind of adds, makes it more of an experience. Zoe's great. Zoe's done work with Alato Negro and a few other friends of mine. So he's pretty amazing. So that's kind of if I play without him, it's just weird. I need to have him with me.
Hey, man.
It just makes it more of an experience.
Also on you.
Yeah.
You do a good job of putting it on the other people, man.
I know, right?
Maybe that's not why you're in the band anymore.
Exactly.
I'm just fucking around, man. Listen, we're short on time, but I want to get one more song in.
Yeah.
So where can people buy your stuff? Where can people, what's the social media?
You can actually grab one of my EPs for free on SoundCloud.
Got it today.
Certain Creatures. I have a 12-inch out on Styles Upon Styles, which you can get on iTunes, or you can buy a physical copy on their Bandcamp page or through Boomcat. And then also Remix 12-inch just came out with a couple remixes from my 12-inch with this dude from Berlin. Named Samuel Carriage, and then another remix from Julia Fields, who's a local Brooklyn guy who's on Lies Records, and it also has a remix from Clay Wilson remixing Best Available Technology, and they're all those, the both releases are all limited to 300, so
get them now.
Yeah,
I mean, it's Sunday, people are home.
Yeah,
order that shit.
Yeah, order that, get it done, man.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Yeah,
no, what's problem. the last one more section?
Well, yeah, we'll do one more section.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks so much.
Cool.
Greg and I will be back next week for a very special and rare birthday episode. It's literally gonna be our birthday.
Oh, wow. Happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
This has been Snacky Tunes. Big shout to Bruce Cost Ginger Ale. It's delicious. I'm definitely going to take some of the stuff out of the fridge. We'll leave some for the other Heritage people. And we will see you next week. Thanks to everybody. Thanks to Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's... Here we go.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.